Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 9 through 46. I'm going to call this section Recap. Leaders are appointed, and Israel refuses to enter the land. The reason I say it's a recap is because this is in the middle of, or the beginning of, actually, a discourse that Moses gave to the children of Israel on the plains of Moab. Our context is this. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 1 through 8, we have an introduction to the book. And the book mostly consists of three speeches that Moses gave to the children of Israel. And this is the beginning of the first speech. So we start now in verses 9, 10, and 11. I spoke to you, that's Moses spoke to you, Israelites, at that time, saying, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone. The Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day like the stars of heaven in number. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you a thousandfold more than you are, and bless you, just as he has promised you. Now, verse 9 refers to a time that Moses has spoken to the people. I spoke to you at that time. What time? Well, this is referring to the rock at Rephidim right before Horeb, right in the first month or so of the Exodus, or let's put it this way, during the first year of the Exodus, they had gotten right down to Mount Horeb, not quite there yet, and they were at Rephidim and ran out of water, and Moses smote the rock and the water came out. Now, why do we know it's at this time? Because later on in this passage here in Deuteronomy 1, Moses is going to talk about the advice that his father-in-law Jethro gave him about dealing with all the numerous Israelites. And so that's how we time it. Now, Moses says in verse 9, I am not able to bear the burden of you alone. He's referring to the numbers of the Israelites. There's so much. Because in verse 10, he says, the Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day like the stars of heaven. So again, he's talking about the great number of Israelites. He can't judge them all, can't handle their law cases, basically. Now, of course, this idea of Israel multiplying is all through Genesis, the promises to Abraham. We'll start with Genesis 13:16. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, which of course they can't, then your descendants can also be numbered. Nobody will be able to number the descendants of Israel. Of course, that's not to be taken literally. They actually did number the descendants of Israel when they took a census. But it's Hebrew hyperbole. It's a metaphor. It's talking about there's going to be tons of Israelites. And as a matter of fact, right now they were up to 600,000 fighting men, as Gil said. That's a round number. I think it was 603,000, somewhere around there. And people estimate around 2 million or so if you count the women and children. So that's too much for Moses to handle. And he continues with this idea of the number of the Israelites. He says, you are this day like the stars of heaven in number. Now, this metaphor of stars in heaven is used a lot in Genesis when God promises the Israelites that they're going to be as numerous as the stars. Genesis 15:5, and he, God, took him, Abraham, outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he, Yahweh, said to him, Abraham, so shall your descendants be. Your descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars. Genesis 22:17, God repeats the promise, indeed I will greatly bless you, Abraham, he's talking to, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of your enemies. Lots of seed, lots of descendants, just like there's lots of stars. And he repeats that promise to Isaac, Abraham's son, in Genesis 26:4. I will multiply your, talking to Isaac, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. Exodus 32:13, going back, or continuing after Genesis to the next book in Exodus 32:13, Moses is praying to God after the golden calf incident when God threatened to wipe them all out. Moses appeals back to Abraham's promise, the promise to Abraham and Isaac. He says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens. Israel's Jacob. So this is a common, well-known promise to the Israelites, and Moses refers to it, stars of heaven. It's mentioned again in Deuteronomy 10, verse 22. Moses is giving a speech to the Israelites, and he says, your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. Also, and another addressed to the Israelites on the plains of Moab. In Deuteronomy 28:62, Moses says this, "Then you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as numerous as the stars of heaven, because you did not obey the Lord your God." This is the famous cursings chapter. You're going to be few if you disobey. Now, this promise that the descendants of Israel would be as numerous as the stars, of course, is not meant to be taken literally. There are an infinite number of stars in heaven. You can't count stars forever. It's just meant to be taken from the point of view of someone on earth counting stars in the sky. If you look up there, you can't count them. There's so many stars, and that's the idea. So many descendants of Israel, they're going to be almost innumerable. He uses another nice word to discuss the numbers of the Israelites. Verse 11, "May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you 1,000-fold more than you are, and bless you just as he has promised you." Moses is still quoting God there. Well, actually, he's quoting himself, what he said back at Rephidim. He said, God's multiplied you. Verse 10 and verse 11, he says, "May the God of your fathers increase you 1,000-fold more than you already are." Right now, you're about 600,000 men, 2 million men, women, and children. But hey, how about 1,000-fold more than that? Well, is that meant to be taken literally? No, of course not. That's a general term. It's not specific. It just means very, very much. It's like the Chinese. They say, wan is 10,000. And then when they say another dictionary definition of wan is innumerable. Not meant to be taken literally, of course. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. "How can I alone," Moses continues, talking to the children of Israel, "how can I alone bear the load and burden of you and your strife?" Again, this is law cases he's referring to, which of course is strife. "Choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. You answered me and said, the thing which you have said to do is good." And remember, this is Moses relating what he spoke back at Rephidim in the first year of the Exodus. We're now in the 40th year of the Exodus as he recounts it to the people. Verse 15, Deuteronomy 1, "So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands and of hundreds, of fifties and of tens, and officers for your tribes. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen, and judge righteously between a man and his fellow countryman, or the alien who is with him." Aliens as well as Israelites were involved in the legal process. Verse 17, "You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me." Moses was a Supreme Court justice. "And I will hear it. I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do." Now in verse 13, Moses appoints heads of the tribes. Now, I assume there's one head of the whole tribe, and then he divides the tribes into thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. So he's got people in charge of subdivisions, very orderly. And he also says officers for your tribes. I don't know what that means, unless it means people to carry out functions that these leaders meant, like represent, like discuss things, send petitions up to Moses. I don't know what the officers are. But Moses says, okay, you guys, you leaders of tribes, thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, you do the judgment and just let me take the appeals courses. If the case is too hard for you, you should bring it to me, he says in verse 37. So that's just basically court administration here. It's interesting to me how Moses connects Jethro's advice, which was good advice, how to set up the court system, with the promise to Abraham. The promise to Abraham says there's going to be lots of you Jews, so we got to deal with them, so we got to have a division of labor here. Now in verse 17, Moses says to the judges he's appointing, "You shall hear the small and the great alike." In other words, the powerless should have justice as well as the great. And that is an incredibly important feature of a just legal system. Now that doesn't mean that the great should be deprived of justice because they are great. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein was a millionaire until he killed himself or until he died. It doesn't mean he shouldn't be allowed a legal defense for his perversions, his alleged perversions. No, big shots deserve fair justice just like small fry do. Now, verse 17, Moses says, "You shall not show partiality in judgment, and you shall not fear man." Well, why would a judge fear man? Well, as John Gill says, it's possible that a judge would fear to give judgment against a rich or powerful litigant. The judges should be above that. They should administer justice impartially, not with fear of big shots. We go now to Deuteronomy 1, verses 19 through 21. Then we, again, this is Moses still talking to the Israelites on the plains of Moab. Then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrible wilderness which you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, just as the Lord our God had commanded us, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, as the Lord the God of your fathers has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed. And verse 19, Moses said that we, the Israelites, set out from Horeb. He's starting to recount the, which should have been the 11-day journey into the promised land from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea, and the next day they would be there. Of course, it took 38 years instead of 11 days. But he's recapitulating what occurred in Numbers 13 and 14. He starts out by saying, we set out from Mount Horeb and we went through that great and terrible wilderness. Well, what wilderness is that? Well, that's the wilderness of Paran, which goes from Mount Sinai up to the past the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, up a little ways heading toward the Dead Sea. I'm not exactly sure where it stopped and the wilderness of Zin began, but that's the idea of where it is. And it's described as terrible here by Moses. Well, I've been down in that region, and I'm telling you, it is terrible. I've been in a lot, which is south of, well, which is close to Sinai. It's not quite there yet, but it's in the same general area, and by golly, it's some of the worst landscape you'll ever see. Here's how Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown describe it, quote, a dreary waste of rock and of calcareous soil covered with black, sharp flints. All travelers, from a feeling of its complete isolation from the world, describe it as a great and terrible wilderness. Yes, sir, buddy, it sure is. I can tell you from firsthand experience. And so Moses mentions that, of course, to show that God got them through that mess. God got them through the wilderness of Paran. After they went through the wilderness of Paran, they were on the way to the hill country of the Amorites. Now, the wilderness of Zin is between the wilderness of Paran and the hill country of the Amorites. That hill country of the Amorites is when you get up toward the Dead Sea, to the west of the Dead Sea, or maybe just to the south of the Dead Sea, right around the southern tip of the Dead Sea, there's the desert of Zin rises to some small hills, and the Amorites and the Amalekites were allied with them. They held that area there. So basically, the hill country of the Amorites is the southern door into the Promised Land, because once you got past that, you run on up into Israel, into Canaan land. So that's what he's talking about when he says the hill country of the Amorites. That's the hills at the south of Canaan and the northern edge of the wilderness of Zin. And then he says that was what they were on their way to. They didn't get there. They came to Kadesh Barnea, which is south of there, south of the wilderness of Zin. So somewhere halfway up between the Gulf of Aqaba and the Dead Sea, out in the desert there to the west of the Araba Valley, is Kadesh Barnea. And people don't know exactly where that was, but I had a lot of trouble with the geography when we were going through this in Numbers, but we'll just say it's somewhere there in the desert. The scholars don't know exactly where it is either. But they got there, and Kadesh Barnea is memorable because that's where they finked out on their desire or their command from God to go into the Promised Land because of the report of the 10 spies who said, there's giants in the land, we can't go in there. So Kadesh Barnea is worth remembering. And so Moses recounts, continuing to recount what God said. He said, God has placed the land before you, go and take possession. Just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. When did God speak to them to take the land? Well, Moses is probably referring to what he had just said in Deuteronomy 1:8. He's relating what God has said to Moses. See, I have set the land before you. Enter and take possession, not just to Moses, but to the people of Israel. See, I have set the land before you. Enter and take possession of the land the Lord swore to give to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their future descendants. This idea that God has spoken a promise. When God speaks, it's going to happen, so don't fear. Go up and take the land because God told you to take it. Don't listen to these 10 deadhead spies, these cowards. Listen to your God who spoke to you. Now, this land promise had been, in Deuteronomy 1:8, a reaffirmation of land promises which had been made earlier to Moses. For example, at the burning bush, way before Moses even was a leader of the people, Exodus 3:8. This is in the wilderness of Midian, right down there, again, near Sinai, the Gulf of Aqaba. Exodus 3:8. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. So this is God speaking, saying, I'm going to deliver them to a land So Moses has this promise in his head because that burning bush experience was something that would stick with your mind. Exodus 3:17, so I, this is God, said, I will bring you up. I, God, will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. So the land promise, just like the offspring promise, was burned into Moses's brain. And of course, not only was Moses promised the land, Abraham, that was part of the famous land promise of Abraham, Genesis 15, etc. And then God said, because I've spoken, do not fear or be dismayed. How many times did God tell the people not to be afraid about this daunting task of conquering Canaan? Deuteronomy 31:8, the Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Joshua 1:9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Joshua 8:1, now the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given your land, given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. And Joshua 10:25, Joshua then said to them, do not fear or be dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies with whom you fight. I can see this would be a good application type homily to give to a Christian congregation. Do not fear or be dismayed. Go up and take the land. Once you hear the voice of God, do what he says and do not fear. Now, the reason it's mentioned so many times is because it was a perfectly logical and rational thing to do, to fear what they had to do. Conquer all those people, I'd be scared too. I'd be scared out of my mind. So God tries to buck them up, tries to encourage them to put courage into their hearts. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. Moses is still recounting what happened back there at Kadesh Barnea, which, by the way, was in the second year of the Exodus after the third month. Then all of you approached me and said, let us send men before us that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way by which we should go up and the cities which we shall enter. The thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe. They turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. Now that hill country there is, again, the hill country of the Amorites right down there near Hebron. Eshcol is Mamre, which is right on top of Hebron almost on the map, and that's at maybe the southern third of the Dead Sea to the west of the Dead Sea. And of course they went all around the land in a clockwise direction, spying out the land, and Eshcol is when they came back. Verse 25, then they took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us, and they brought us back a report and said, it is a good land which the Lord our God is about to give us. Now, of course, the people who are given the good report there, that's Joshua and Caleb. They're the ones that cut the grapes. Eshcol means cluster. And this was a huge cluster of grapes they had to put on a stick. Two men had to carry it. Said, look here, this is a symbol of how rich this land is that we're going to take. The Lord our God is about to give it to us. Now we notice in verse 22, Moses says, then all of you approached me and said, let us send men. It's interesting. It wasn't Moses' idea to send those spies into Canaan. It was the people of Israel. Now this tells me that this passage here shows that a good leader is willing to listen to the ones he leads. Moses heard that. He said, that's a good idea. I think I'll do it. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, on the other hand, said that the people asked out of unbelief. If they'd really believed, they would have said, hey, God's told us to go. We'll go. We don't need to send spies. And I think that's super spiritual. I mean, that's like God telling me, I'm going to give you food to eat. And I say, well, I won't believe you till you make the food get cooked on its own and you make the fork levitate and stick into the mashed potatoes, and then the fork levitates and comes into my mouth. Come on, God uses natural means, and it would be military prudence to spy out a land in which you are trying to enter. That's called military intelligence. So I think Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is wrong when he's saying that these people were acting out of unbelief when they approached Moses and asked for spies. Now, the names of these men are actually mentioned in Numbers 13. I'm not going to mention them again. I mentioned that Eshcol, if you look in BibleAtlas.org, Eshcol pulls up Mamre, the famous oaks of Mamre. I hope they're right. That's my authority for maps. And of course, Mamre was where Moses had all the, not Moses, I'm sorry, Abraham had all of his tombs for his people. Sarah and Abraham were buried there, as well as a lot of the other. Rachel was not. I believe that Isaac was there. Rebecca was there, if my memory serves me correct. So it's a famous place, actually. Eshcol was. We go now to Deuteronomy 1, verses 26 through 28. Yet you were not willing to go up, Moses continues his speech to the Israelites. Yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you grumbled in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying, the people are bigger and taller than we. The cities are large and fortified to heaven. And besides, we saw the sons of the Anakim there. Well, so Joshua and Caleb brought some grapes and said, woo, this is a prosperous land. But the other 10 spies start talking about giants and fortified cities. And so they gave a bad report. And as a result, in verse 26, Moses says, you are not willing to go up. Now, here's an interesting hermeneutical point. NIV Study Bible points out that you does not refer literally to the children of Israel being addressed. Moses says, you are not willing to go up. But remember now, these are the people that did not sin. These were the people under 20 years old. They'd grown up, and when they were kids when the Israelites refused to listen to the good spies, Joshua and Caleb's report, and go into Canaan and take the land. Those were children at that time. And when the people of Israel refused to go in, they were children. They were not responsible for that decision. So Moses is talking to people who were children then, but who are adults now. And yet he still calls them you. He says, you are not willing to go up. And that's because he identifies the children of Israel as a unit. It's just like the cells of my body die and are replaced, but it's still me. This is a good point to remember. I remember I was reading a book by D.D. Warren, the Orthodox Preterist, who has a fantastic commentary on the Olivet Discourse called It's Not the End of the World. A great title. If you're an Orthodox Preterist, it's a great title. And she made the point that a lot of preterists, Orthodox preterists, will say, you means you. And so when somebody's being addressed in the Bible, it's talking about back then, not in the future. And that generally is true, but it's not always true. And so she cautioned the preterists to not ride that thing so hard. And I think she's exactly right. And here's an example of where you does not mean the same you, where the you means somebody different than the audience being addressed. Here's another example that the NIV Study Bible gives of this you being different than the people being addressed. Deuteronomy 5:2, the Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Well, Deuteronomy 5 is in year 40 of the Exodus, and the covenant at Horeb was in year 1, the end of year 1, 39 years earlier than that. And so it was a different group of people that the covenant was being made with, but it still says the covenant was made with us, even though they were too young to be partakers of that covenant in Deuteronomy 5:2. Now the people, Moses said, began to grumble in their tents. They didn't want to go up and take the land like they were supposed to, and so they grumbled in their tents. Now later on, that grumbling, that murmuring became public. If we go back and read in Numbers 14, the whole people challenged Moses and said, we're not going. And the people grumbled in their tents and they said, because the Lord hates us. Now, the Lord hates us, and because of that, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. Really now, is that got to be the stupidest thing you have ever heard? Fear will make people do stupid things. I refer to the COVID-19 pandemic as an application. People are scared to death, and they will do dumb things in order to deal with their fear, like lock down a whole economy, make little kids wear masks to schools all day, make you wear a mask to get on an airplane or go into a restaurant. Fear will do a number on people. And so these people were afraid. And so they lashed out at God. After all that God had done for them, good gravy, how about the parting of the Red Sea? Oh, yeah, God's trying to destroy the Israelites. Now, the Amorites are mentioned by the people. The Amorites are going to destroy us. Now, who are the Amorites? That's the strongest of the pagan tribes in Canaan. They're kind of like the poster boys. You see, we want to talk about Canaanites. Talk about the Amorites. Let me quote you, give you a selective quote from Easton's Dictionary. The Amorites were warlike mountaineers. They are represented on the Egyptian monuments with fair skins, light hair, blue eyes, aquiline noses, and pointed beards. They stand out on those Egyptian monuments because the Egyptians were kind of dark brown and the Amorites were fair skinned. And so they were obviously different people, but they referred to both with pictures, painted on the monuments down there, and also in the text that they've that archaeologists have discovered. So they were famous. They are supposed to have been men of great stature, Easton continues. Their king Og is described by Moses as the last of the remnant of the giants in Deuteronomy 3:11. Only one word of the Amorite language survives, Shinir, the name they gave to Mount Hermon, that famous mountain in the north of Israel. So that's who the Amorites were. The spies told Moses when they got back from Eshcol, the 10 cowardly spies said the fortified cities in the land of Canaan go all the way up to heaven. That's just hyperbole, of course. The walls of a city don't go up to heaven. It just means they were very, very high and we can't take them. Now, verse 28, at the end of verse 28, the 10 cowardly spies said that they saw the sons of the Anakim there in the land of Canaan. Who are the sons of the Anakim? Well, first of all, the NIV has it as Anakites, so we're not going to. The sons of Anakim are the Anakites. They were the early inhabitants of Canaan, according to the NIV Study Bible. In other words, they were aboriginal. They were there before the Amorites were, and the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites, and the Hivites, and all those ites. The Anakim were there earlier than that. They're described as giants, as the NIV Study Bible points out. I'm going to give you a lot of scriptures here describing the Anakim, these aboriginal giants. Deuteronomy 2:10, the Eman lived there formerly, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. Deuteronomy 2:21, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. It's referring to another race of people called the Eman, who are like the Anakim, who are sort of the poster boys for giants. Deuteronomy 9:2, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? Numbers 13:22, when they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. So the descendants of Anak lived near Hebron, where Caleb was eventually going to take. Numbers 13:32, 10 verses later, so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people who we saw in it are men of great size. Giants, NBA players. So the ten spies who gave a bad report, they weren't lying. I mean, there were giants in the land, but the point is God says, I'm going to give you victory over everything that's there. So they spread fear and panic. Here's a quote from ChristianAnswers.net that shows that the Anakim were aboriginal before the other seven Canaanite nations. Quote, they were probably a remnant of the original inhabitants of Palestine before the Canaanites. In other words, the Anakites used to be there in full force, but they were dying out, and they were just a remnant by the time the Israelites got there. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 29 through 31. Then I said to you, Moses continues with his little speech, then I said to you, Israelites, do not be shocked, nor fear them. This is back at the time in the second year of the Exodus when they're at Kadesh Barnea getting ready to hopefully take over the land, but they didn't do it. At that time, Moses says, I said to you, do not be shocked nor fear them, the Anakim, the giants, the fortified cities, the inhabitants of the Canaan land. Don't be afraid of them. Verse 30, the Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight on your behalf, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you, just as a man carries his son in all the way which you have walked until you came to this place. Now, Moses is here giving us some extra information. The speech that Moses gives here is not recorded in Numbers 14, as John Gill points out, when he tells them, don't be shocked, don't fear them. That's not in Numbers 14. This is added here. He says in verse 30, the Lord your God who goes before you, that of course refers to the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, that famous Shekinah glory cloud, he will go before you and fight on your behalf, just as he did for you in Egypt. Well, how did God fight for the Israelites in Egypt? Well, remember the parting of the Red Sea, the events of the escape from the Red Sea, the escape from Egypt and going through the Red Sea, is the NIV Study Bible. That's what's being referred to here. He fought for you in Egypt, got you out of the country. And then he says, once you got out of the country into the wilderness, the Lord your God carried you. How did he carry the Israelites? He fed them with manna. He brought water out of the rocks. How about the quail that when they were hungry? He protected them from every harmful creature. Their shoes didn't wear out. He fought their battles. He gave them victories over the Amalekites, Sihon and Og, the Amorites, there at the end. But the Israelites said, oh, God hates us. Deuteronomy 1, verses 32 through 36. But for all this, you did not trust the Lord your God. Well, you know, I need to go back and be careful here. He says, in the wilderness, you saw how the Lord your God carried you. Well, that's true, but the time frame we're here is at Kadesh Barnea in year 2 of the Exodus, and all that Sihon and Og battles, that was year 40, so I shouldn't have mentioned that, I guess. But all that other stuff, feeding with the manna and so forth, happened before year 2. We go now to Deuteronomy 1, verses 32 through 36. But for all this, you did not trust the Lord your God, who goes before you on your way to seek out a place for you to encamp, in fire by night and cloud by day, to show you the way in which you should go. Then the Lord heard the sound of your words, and he was angry and took an oath, saying, not one of these men, this evil generation, shall see the good land which I swore to give your fathers, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and to his sons I will give the land on which he has set foot, because he has followed the Lord fully. And if you ask me, what about Joshua? That's coming up in a couple of verses, so we'll hold off on Joshua. In verse 32, when Moses says you didn't trust the Lord your God, he's referring to the fact that they wouldn't go in and take the land. And the author of the book of Hebrews actually mentions that lack of trust in Hebrews 3:19. For so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. So this is a big event in the history of Israel. The applications of this, of course, are very easy if you're a preacher wanting to encourage your Christian flock to do something that's hard and difficult. Well, you're not going to get in. You're not going to get victory over that thing unless you enter in with belief. Moses says in verse 34 that God heard the sound of their words. That would be the murmurings against Moses and Aaron, against Joshua and Caleb. Their rash wishes that they had died in the wilderness. I'd rather be dead here. I want to go. Or how about their desire to return to Egypt again? I want to go back to Egypt where it's safe and secure with the leeks and the garlic so we can eat. Yeah, right. They were slaves. They weren't going to be eating any leeks and garlics. So God heard all that nonsense, all their words, and then he got angry and took an oath. Now, God can take an oath on himself. There's no one else higher by which he can swear. And for all of the Amish Mennonite type of Christians that are reading this Bible here, reading this verse, we need to realize that if God can take an oath and we imitate God, why can't we take an oath? The prohibitions against oath-taking, the so-called prohibitions against oath-taking in Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, that's talking about taking rash oaths or oaths that were not meant to be kept because you're playing games with the language. It's not talking about serious oaths. It's okay to take one of those if it's not a rash oath. Like in court, it's serious that you take an oath that you don't perjure yourself. Now, this oath that God took when he got angry with the Israelites is recorded in Numbers 14:28. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. In other words, I'm going to speak to you. You spoke to me. You grumbling with your words, I'm going to speak to you. Verse 36, God tells Caleb that, well, he doesn't tell Caleb, he's telling Moses that he's going to give to Caleb the land on which he has set foot. That means Caleb actually went in there and saw it. He did. He came back. He got the land around Hebron, ran the giants out. Because he, Caleb, has followed the Lord fully. We see that in Numbers 14:24. But my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit, that means a different spirit from the 10 cowardly spies, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, same words there, followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Moses continues with his recap to the children of Israel in verses 37 through 40. The Lord was angry with me, Moses, also on your account because of you Israelites. God's angry with me, saying, not even you shall enter there. Not even you, Moses, is going to enter into the promised land. Verse 38, Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter there. Encourage him, for he will cause Israel to inherit the land. Moreover, your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your sons, who this day have no knowledge of good and evil, shall enter there. Now, Moses didn't say that their kids would be a prey, but he's talking about the Israelites said that their kids were going to be a prey. Well, no, God's saying, no, the kids are not going to be a prey. They're going to enter in too. And I will give it to them, and they shall possess it. But as for you, as for you, Israelites, rebellious Israelites, turn around and set out for the wilderness by the way to the Red Sea. Now, when was God angry with Moses in verse 37? That was when Moses struck the rock at Meribah. near Kadesh Barnea at the end of the 38 years of the wandering. Gil says it's about 38 years, a year and a fraction to go to Mount Sinai, build the tabernacle, celebrate the Passover, then take out and get to Kadesh Barnea. It's a year and a fraction. It's not clear exactly how much of that second year took to get to Kadesh Barnea. So it's 38 plus years. They've been wandering around. They get to Meribah. The people griping because they don't have any water. And Moses struck the rock. Now, why did God get angry at Moses for striking the rock? That is a highly controverted position. I think when I went over that, it was about 12 or 13 different ideas, options you could take on that. I think the simplest thing to say is he got angry with the people and struck the rock, and that's not what leaders are supposed to do. It made God look bad. Doesn't look good. But at any rate, for whatever reason, the Lord was angry. He was angry with Moses on your account, Israelites. In other words, if you hadn't grumbled there at Meribah near Kadesh Barnea, if you hadn't grumbled, I wouldn't have gotten angry, and then God wouldn't have gotten angry with me. And in verse 37, God says, not even you, Moses, not even you, he says even because he's the leader, not even you as leader of Israel, not even the leader of Israel is going to enter into the promised land because of what you did. Now, Moses didn't like that. He actually begged God to change his mind. Deuteronomy 3, verse 25, let me, referring to Moses, let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon. He wanted to see it. I don't blame him after leading those people for 40 years and now he's told he can't go in. It's terrible. But no, God didn't let him go in. He says in verse 38, I want you to encourage Joshua. He will cause Israel to inherit the land. And Moses did exactly what God told him to do. We read in Deuteronomy 31:7. Then Moses called to Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall give it to them as an inheritance. Just speaking words of success to people when they're under stress, it's very, very important to do that. Words are powerful. Just talking to a brother whose wife has made him move out, and he's blaming himself. And probably the wife was right in what she said about him, but they were Christians, and there was no adultery. I mean, there's no right for them to get divorced. There's no need for them to get divorced. They got three beautiful kids. So I just started telling him, let's don't be talking about divorce now. You got kids. You know, I didn't mention the Bible. I didn't want to hit him too hard with that. But, you know, I just kept saying, you are going to straighten up. You are going to get through this. I don't know whether it encouraged him or not, but I believe that's what you should instinctively do to people who are devastated or defeated. So Moses encouraged Joshua. Verse 39, God is talking to Moses back there in the past, back at Meribah. Moreover, your little ones who you said would become a prey and your sons shall enter. When did God say that they will come be a prey? Actually, not when did God say. When did the Israelites say that their sons will become a prey? This was at the time of the listening to the report of the bad spies. They said, no, we're not going to go in there. Our kids are going to die. Numbers 14:3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So that's when they said that their sons would become a prey in Numbers 14, verse 3. And of course, God says it's ironic that you say that because they're the ones that go, they're going to go in, or it's you that are going to fall down in the sand. Your corpses are going to lie in the dust because of your unbelief. But your little ones that you said were going to die in the wilderness, actually, they're going to survive and they're going to go in and they're going to inherit the land. But in contrast to them who are going in to inherit the land, look at you. You're going to have to turn around and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. Now, if you look at the map, Kadesh Barnea is at the top of the northern edge of the wilderness of Paran. And then if you go a little bit east, you hit the Araba Valley between the Dead and the Red Sea, the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba. You hit that Gulf of Araba, then you go south, you hit Eilat at the tip of the Red Sea. That's what he's referring to here. Turn around and head back south. Now, of course, the people disobeyed that command. They tried to, instead of going south, try to go north through the hill country of the Amorites and the Amalekites there at the southern Canaan. And they were repulsed with great loss, as we learned about in Numbers 14. We've already talked about that. So once again, the people are continuing to be disobedient. We now turn to Deuteronomy 1, verses 41 through 46, and we will finish this chapter. Then you, Moses continues his speech, you Israelites said to me, Moses, we have sinned against the Lord. We will indeed go up and fight just as the Lord our God commanded us. Now that's referring to when the Israelites said, yeah, we sinned. We shouldn't have listened to those bad spies. We should have listened to Joshua and Caleb. So now we're going to fix it. We're going to fix it and go up and fight the Amorites in the hill country south of Canaan. And that is a good example of how you try to fix your sins in the flesh. You confess your sin, then try to make restitution for your sins without listening to God. Because God didn't tell them to go fight the Amorites in the hill country. He told them to go south, down there to the Red Sea, to the Gulf of Aqaba. And so Moses continues, every man of you girded on his weapons of war and regarded it as easy to go up into the hill country. That's the hill country of the Amorites, or the hill country of Israel, which is even further north than the spine of Israel, if you look at it that way. Oh, it's going to be easy to go up there. And the Lord said to me, say to them, do not go up nor fight, for I am not among you. Otherwise, you will be defeated before your enemies. So I spoke to you, Moses spoke to you, Israel, but you, Israel, would not listen. Instead, you, Israel, rebelled against the command of the Lord and acted presumptuously and went up into the hill country. The Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do and crushed you from Seir to Hormah. Then you returned and wept before the Lord. Ah, more crocodile tears. But the Lord did not listen to your voice nor give ear to you. So you remained in Kadesh many days, the days that you spent there. Now, verse 41, where it says, we have sinned against the Lord, when Moses is recounting the Israelites confessing that they have sinned against the Lord, well, the sin that they did was total rebellion. Deuteronomy 1, verse 26, yet you were not willing to go up, Moses says, but you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And that shows that rebellion and sin are predicates of each other. Rebellion is sin, and sin is rebellion. Is that not what sin is, living a life independent of God? These Israelites first rebelled against the command to go into the land, and then God gave them a command not to go into the land. They rebelled against that. They did exactly the opposite of what God was telling them to do. So when they agreed to go into the land, God had changed his command. He said, go south to the Red Sea, don't go north into the land. But they are not going to listen to him. And so God says, I'm not among you. So they go up into the hill countries of the Amorites, and they get chased, it says. The Amorites chased you as bees do. Well, if you've ever been chased by bees, and I've been chased by wasps, but never been chased by, I think I've been chased by a couple of bees. I haven't been chased by a swarm of bees. But there's two points to this analogy, the number of bees that are coming after you and the fury of bees. Because I'm telling you, bees can get really, really mad. I live in the country, and I've been chased by wasps, and I'm telling you, they come after you. You're in bad shape. I remember I got some wasps mad. Spraying them with something that didn't quite take them out. I either missed or the thing ran out of power, out of gas, the little can I was using of insect spray. And those wasps came after me. And I knew that I had to fight them off or I was going to be in the hospital because they get real, real angry. And bees are just like wasps. I've heard it said that these ground bees that have their nest underground with a little hole at the top, I've seen them out here in the country. And little kids will step on one of those holes and the bees get mad. They're not bees. They're hornets or wasps. I can't remember what they are. Actually, I think they are bees, ground bees. Anyway, they come out of that hole and start stinging a kid and the kid will die. Dangerous.
So,
anyway, it's a great analogy if you've actually experienced these swarms of bee-like animals. It's horrible. And so the Israelites got crushed from Seir to Hormah. Now, Seir is that mountain range that goes all the way in the Arabah Valley from the southern tip of the Dead Sea to the northern tip of the Red Sea of the Gulf of Aqaba. So on the east side of the Arabah Valley there. And so somewhere in those mountains, in Mount Seir, they were beaten. And they were beaten as they ran all the way to Hormah. Nobody knows exactly where Hormah is in the desert. It's got a question mark in BibleAtlas.org. In the BibleAtlas.org map. But basically what it means is you got your fannies whipped, Israel. Verse 45, then you returned and wept before the Lord. That means they came back to the camp of Kadesh Barnea, which is where they were poised, getting ready to go into the promised land until they rebelled. Now it says in verse 46, you remain in Kadesh many days, the days you spent there. Well, how long did they stay in Kadesh after they rebelled and before they turned back and went south to the Gulf of Aqaba in the Red Sea. Some people think it was actually years that they stayed there at Kadesh Barnea. John Gill, quoting some rabbis that he read, said that the rabbis claimed that the Israelites camped for 19 of the 38 years they wandered at Kadesh Barnea. Well, I don't know about that. It's not clear, but they stayed for Kadesh Barnea for a long time, then they wandered. And again, they don't know exactly where they wandered either. They could have just gone around and around in circles right down there in the desert wilderness of Paran there. Who knows, but it was a sad, sad situation. And again, we're finished with the chapter, but let's put a little cap on this. The reason that Moses is going through all of this rebellion and sadness and stupidity that the Israelites did, he's trying to warn them. He says, look, all the bad stuff happened because you rebelled against God. If you just listened to him, you wouldn't have to go through that 38 years of wandering. So listen to him now, because you're getting ready to go into the promised land. You need to obey, because this is not going to be an easy task. It will be a successful task if you listen to God, but you better listen to him, and you better not rebel like you did before, or bad things are going to happen. I'm sure that's what Moses was getting at. Ladies and gentlemen, we finished with Deuteronomy chapter 1. In our next session, we'll take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 2. I'm going to cut it up a little bit. We'll go through verses 1 through 25. We'll continue with Moses' recap, as he will recap those wilderness years, those 38 years of wandering around like a bunch of aimless morons. So I hope you listen in to that sad story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.